You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrowitz, and this is our latest look at the Cleveland Indians. I'm joined by Jordan Bastian, and we are looking ahead to 2017 and kind of what's next for the defending AL champs. Obviously, JB, it's been a quiet winter in the aftermath of that electric World Series and Game 7 loss. The Indians are kind of playing that waiting game, which makes a ton of sense in this market. It's kind of their needs align with where the market was at its deepest. And it makes a lot of sense to kind of sit back, and we keep calling it the game of musical chairs for a reason. That's exactly what it is. There's only so many spots to go around for the number of, first base and DH type slugging bats. The Indians are in a pretty good spot to be patient.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've talked about this multiple times, but the Indians entered into the offseason with very few holes to fill. So it's a situation where, given the marketplace for that need for power, for right-handed power, they were going to take this patient approach. And so far, it looks like it's the smart approach, because those guys are out there still wondering where they're going to get these contracts from. And the teams are sitting back, just sort of waiting for the price levels to come down to where they're comfortable signing them. So I think the Indians are taking the prudent approach there. And then, otherwise, I mean, we're talking about trying to find, complementary left-handed relievers. We're talking about maybe looking at some guys to fortify the bench or the depth at the AAA level in case there's injuries at the major league level. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of holes. So when you're a team like that, you're not going to have a ton of players knocking on your door because the job opportunities aren't there. And B, the types of guys that actually make the most sense typically are January, February type signings. So it's been really, really quiet so far, but I think the level of quiet speaks in a way to the strength of the Indians' major league roster at the moment.
And they did sign a former Blue Jays first baseman, but it was Chris Colabello to a minor league deal and not Edwin Encarnacion to a major league deal. We can talk about both of these guys, really. Let's start with Encarnacion, just because he is the big name still dangling out there in the market. And really, it's looking like the biggest mistake of the hot stove season was he turned down 4 years and $80 million from the Blue Jays and then went out there into uncharted waters. And the market just kind of collapsed around him. He's going to be 34 in 2017, primarily a DH. I think he's played and finished only 81 games at first base over the last two seasons combined. And he's attached to a draft pick. So he's got all these issues working against him. And all those issues that work against him kind of work for the Indians. But it still seems like not particularly likely. I think because when you add in the value of the draft pick and just, we know where the Indians' finances usually go in the free agent realm, and it's not the guys of this caliber. We did see Michael Bourne kind of quote unquote fall in their lap a few years back. Didn't turn out very well, but it did happen, and maybe that happens here. But it seems like his market has to totally crater for this to be realistic.
Right, and the thing that you got to remember about the Michael Bourne and Nick Swisher signings, forget the hindsight for a moment. Those were two big deals at the time, and at the time, the Indians, the way their draft picks were set up, they had a protected first-round draft pick. They had an extra pick in a supplemental round. So they were a little more comfortable with losing draft picks, knowing that they had extra draft picks to sort of have a normal draft. So that was very unique circumstances. But in terms of Encarnacion, now they have to deal with the idea that they do have a supplemental round pick, so they do have that, but not to the same extent that they did in that decision several years ago. I honestly think I'm wondering if, Encarnacion is also waiting out where these other guys are going. Let's say the Orioles ultimately do not sign Mark Trumbo, then maybe the Orioles have a little more incentive to then shift their attention to Encarnacion. So maybe Encarnacion's camp's thinking, I got to wait to see where Trumbo lands. Maybe that will open up an opportunity for a larger contract. I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, when Chris Davis was on the market, he had turned down an offer and it looked like a poor decision. And then the Orioles ended up coming back with a huge contract that he ended up going back to Baltimore with. So, we've seen situations like this play out in the past. But I think it, again, makes sense for Cleveland with their financial limitations to sit back, you know, wait for that price range to potentially get back into their realm. And they have the good selling point of being the reigning AL pennant winners, you know, so they have a job opportunity and they're a winning team. You know, that has to carry some weight as well. But again, we haven't even discussed Mike Napoli, but it continues to seem like he would be, once again, the better fit on a short-term deal just because it wouldn't cost a pick, wouldn't cost as much money, and both parties know what they have in each other.
Right. Yeah, if you're betting the house, that's the bet, although, you know, don't bet the house. But, maybe Colabello is the insurance plan if they don't re-sign Napoli, because then you still have a right-handed hitting Italian-American first baseman, within your grasp. But, obviously he was a feel-good story until he wasn't. A guy who spent about 6 or 7 years in independent ball and then had this breakout, late career breakout with the Twins and then the Blue Jays had a really strong year in 2015. And really mashed left-handed pitching and had an 886 OPS, but then banged for PEDs in 2016 and only played 10 games with Toronto in 2016. So he comes aboard on a minor league deal and just one of those, bring him to camp and see what you got.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously anyone that could help exploit a platoon advantage, the Indians are going to have interest there. Even despite the PED issue, from people I've talked to and, from the stories I've read, he seems like the general assumption is that this was a high-character guy. So I think a lot of people were surprised when that happened. When I covered Toronto in the playoffs 2 years ago, I was helping out on the Blue Jays coverage, and I, dealt with him a couple times. And, great to talk to, and from talking to other players in that room, they really spoke highly of him as a leader within the clubhouse and just a great presence, given his background and his story and how far he had come and what he had overcome to reach the big leagues and be on that team. Now, obviously, we can view that through a different light now, given, that he tested positively. But, the Indians aren't known for taking in bad characters. This regime really focuses, puts a high priority on, having guys that are character guys and also good role players and good in the clubhouse. And you can bet, given what came out on Colabello, that they did their due diligence before adding him to their major league camp. So it'll probably have to be a situation that, depending on what they do, it's that first base DH slot, a guy that they can bring in, give him a shot to earn a place on the roster. And if not, if he's willing to go to AAA, you have some decent depth there.
All right. Well, the fun about the Indians right now is they're going to do something. They've kind of been laying in the weeds here thus far in the hot stove season. So something's coming. Maybe it'll be something bigger than expected. Maybe it'll be exactly as expected with Mike Napoli, or maybe it'll be some other surprise coming in store. But Jordan Bashan will be all over it for MLB.com. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. This is our latest look at the Chicago White Sox. And we are flipping the calendar to 2017 with Scott Merkin and Merk. I think with the White Sox, the question is not so much what's next as much as it's who's next. Who's next to go in this rebuild process that has already compelled the trades of Chris Sale and Adam Eaton. No shortage of trade candidates on this club. There's a chance that this roster could look exactly the same going into spring training, but there's probably equally as strong as a chance that that another move is made. What do you think is going to happen here in the next couple months?
I think it's so hard to say, because one thing Rick Hahn has done tremendously in the first couple stages of this rebuild is he's stuck to his targets. He is not, if a team came back and said, we want Sale, but we'll give you, Moncada, but not Kopech. Rick is, and I'm just using that hypothetically. I haven't heard that directly, but he's not moving off his demand. So Jose Quintana could be the opening day starter for the White Sox. He could be traded if the three or four elite players they ask for are returned. That's what it all comes down to. And I think the other thing is, don't ever rule out the three-team deal with Rick, because Rick seems to be kind of the master of that. So maybe, look at his example, the Yankees. I've read reports that they're not willing, understandably, to part with some of their top-notch prospects. So maybe you can take one from there and get another team in and work it all, together. So that's a possibility. But Yeah, I mean, it could be spring training where they have the name tag saying, hello, my name is, because there's so many new guys on there. Or it could be Sale and Eaton are the only ones who are traded as of the start of spring training. Not saying that Moore couldn't go in spring training, Moore couldn't go the trade deadline. As Rick has stressed a number of times, this rebuild process is ongoing, you know, into next offseason for that matter.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process. And, you know, within that, of course, they're still fielding a team in 2017. It's not like they're,
right.
You know, going shorthanded. Do you see any moves on the 2017 front, or is it it's pretty much all prospect acquisition, or are there any areas of this club they're still looking to improve for 2017?
Well, they need a catcher. I mean, they have Omar Narvaez, who had a nice, impressive showing last year. He's kind of a, you know, a scout's find who has developed over the couple of years in the Sox system. Worked very well with Carlos Rodon. You can see in the numbers with Carlos Rodon how well they match together. Handled Quintana well. So, you know, he's definitely a guy who could be a two or three start a week guy. So, you know, you don't need to go out. They probably are not going to, I can almost assuredly say they're not going to go out and get like someone such as Matt Wieters, who would be a frontline guy. But I think they're going to probably look at another guy who could split the time with Narvaez back there. So kind of have co-starting catchers, you know, with Zach Collins, they're one of their top prospects before this influx of talent in the trades. At targeted right now as the catcher of the future, probably in 2018, somewhere in that year. You know, they probably could use another outfielder, a center fielder, and there are some, you know, non-tender guys, some other free agents who could, you know, come on a one-year deal and they might add on. So like you said, they haven't waived off 2017. They're going to play 2017. And you know, it would be interesting, obviously, you lose Chris Sale and Adam Eaton, who was a dynamic presence both offensively and defensively. But you lose Sale out of the rotation. That's a big dip. But, you know, what does this team look like? What is their competitive stature if those are the only two that are gone? Is it a team that can still fight for 500, which would seem to kind of, you know, they haven't talked about the quote-unquote tanking part of the rebuild process, which you see, you know, other teams don't plan to do that, but because they trade something, they end up losing 9,500 games. But would this team be better than that if these are the only two that go? You know, I mean, I think Todd Frazier still has a market out there. David Robertson's market seems to have understandably gone cold with all the free agent signings and trades for closers. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see Melky Cabrera. This team could look a lot different at the start of spring training, but I would think it really could look different come next August 1st at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the market conditions, you know, they don't make Abreu particularly movable, of course. You know,
First
base DH market being what it is. And then Frazier probably falls in that as well. I mean, the third base market, it wasn't especially lively. I think that's part of how Justin Turner ended up back with the Dodgers.
Right. So, I'm not sure what you think of this one. I know Cleveland had huge interest in Frazier last year.
I think
Cleveland was the team pursuing Frazier with the Sox, you know, making the best offer in the trade. I don't know exactly. This would be based on if Napoli didn't come back to Cleveland, obviously. If Frazier would be a guy who'd fit over there playing third, first, DH, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I just, again, I don't think in this market it makes much sense because, you know, eventually Napoli or somebody else will follow them. It's just going to work
exactly that
way, the game of musical chairs.
Right.
But, you know, there is something to be said there for upgrading at third base with a full-time third baseman and letting Jose Ramirez kind of stay in a role where he navigates between the outfield and the field. I think there's an argument for that. But ultimately,
so again,
I think they'll
theory,
do the simple. It's not totally out of the water.
That,
it's just,
yeah. The Sox fans want things to happen tomorrow. They have this buzz, this adrenaline rush of prospects, but it may not happen for a month or two. It may not happen for 3 or 4 months. You know, it's just the way the market plays out at this point.
Yeah. But yeah, it's certainly gonna be a fascinating team in July. And even think about Derek Holland as kind of a bounce back candidate, you know, change of scenery type on a 1 year deal, you know, maybe you flip him at the deadline if he comes through as hoped.
I've been told also Derek Holland is a big Michigan fan. So that,
He may
be asked to be traded by the time spring training's over after I wear him out on the Ohio State-Michigan game at that point. That's why
the pride
I think
of Newark, Ohio right there.
Chris Getz eventually went to the front office to get away from my Michigan questions, I think, pretty much.
So it'll be an interesting year, one way or another, Merck. But
for sure.
Really, what you do, you kind of take a step back and just see that it is. It's kind of fun to be a White Sox fan right now because you can dream on these guys a little bit. And Yoan Moncada, you know, whenever we see him on a full-time basis, I mean, there's going to be a lot of excitement there. And, you know, Giolito and Lopez, as these guys develop, you know, be it in the rotation or perhaps in the bullpen, in Lopez's case, is you know, some scouts think that's where his future might lie. But one way or another, I mean, these are highly prized arms. Kopech, of course. Just a lot of, I think I'm going to do a lot of upside writing in your future, which is better than writing about everything going wrong.
Yeah, I may end up seeing Charlotte as much as I see Chicago next year, writing on the. But yeah, I mean, I can tell you from living in Chicago and everything else, seeing on Twitter and just talking to people, fans are thrilled. I mean, I don't think they fully comprehend, because they're so happy about who they got in return that they just traded away one of the best pitchers in baseball at a really team friendly contract. But I think I'm not overlooking Eaton either, but Sale was kind of the face of the franchise, But I mean, they're thrilled at who they got back. And again, you never know. Moncada might be, Robinson Cano. He may be an average player. No one knows at this point, because he only had, 19 plate appearances in the major league level. But the fans really, as you pointed out, the fans really like that the team is going in a direction. They've committed to one way. They're not piecemealing things together. This is going to happen, and they're willing to wait a year or two or whatever. Although scouts have told me that it may be quicker than they think, because the talent they got is so impressive.
Yeah. All right. Well, Scott Merkin will be all over whatever happens next, or whoever goes next, with Chicago White Sox over at MLB.com. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extra Chicago White Sox Edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Detroit Tigers. I'm joined by Jason Beck. Beck, we're going to kind of look ahead here in 2017 and talk about what's next for the Tigers in this hot stove season. And, it's been a quiet hot stove season. And you kind of didn't know what it would be as we went into it. It could have been very active on the trade front, just given the transition period this team is in from a payroll perspective. But it just seems like they've run into a situation where their assets, their trade assets, are not particularly marketable given the contracts involved or just the needs around the league. They kind of run into a wall a little bit, it seems.
Well, first of all, don't downplay the return of Omar Infante and Alex Preston.
That's true.
It's been an active offseason. No, I've been trying to figure it out. I've been talking with people just what it is that the Tigers expected to do and what, in fact, they've run into. I think if it was any other offseason with some of the talent that they had to offer, maybe they could have gotten a bigger deal done. But you get the sense that what they had thought going into the winter, that with such a shallow free agent market, that they would have tradable commodities and they can kind of get a jump start on getting younger and getting the payroll under control, that a lot of other teams were thinking the same thing. And maybe teams that weren't in the same financial straits payroll-wise and luxury tax-wise that the Tigers were in. But when you put Verlander potentially on the same trade market as Chris Sale, it's a tough sell. If you put Ian Kinser on the same potential trade market as Brian Dozier, it's... Even if the talent's similar, the age difference, and I think the contract difference, it's tough to make deals if you're still looking for top prospects. And I think what's become clear is that there's a difference between the fire sale that we all thought the Tigers might be making with the will trade our veterans for top prospects that Al Avila has apparently been looking to do. And at some point, the rubber meets the road. And if you do have to move salary, it's got to go. And I feel like we've gone past that point. And the fact that the Tigers are still here makes you suspect that this team and its payroll are going to get one last go around here before payroll corrects itself naturally by way of expiring contracts.
Yeah, so what's ahead? It seems like one of those things where if they're not going to move anybody, if the conditions just don't align for that, it basically looked very much the same going into 2017.
Yeah, it's a very similar lineup. You hope to get the benefit of Justin Upton knowing the American League now for a full season, and you try to see if Lloyd McClendon, who did, I think, an underrated job as Tigers hitting coach for his years under Jim Leland, if he can work some of that same magic now in the reprisal and kind of get more of that last month and a half that Upton posted this past season and stretch that out over a full season. If you do that, I think you've got a borderline MVP candidate. Now, Upton's history suggests that he doesn't have that consistency in him, but, you know, maybe at age 30, that type of thing shows up. You've got the makings of a potentially very good rotation, depending on if you can get Jordan Zimmerman back healthy. I mean, and if you can get youngsters like Daniel Norris and Matt Boyd to take the next step and put them alongside Michael Fulmer and then try to get a similar season out of Verlander. The one question you have is that gaping hole in center field where Maben's trade kind of set up the expectations that this could be a fire sale type of offseason for the Tigers, but it didn't happen. As a result, you didn't get that hotshot prospect or hotshot young controllable player you thought you might be able to plug in the center field. But at the same time, with payroll as it is, they're not going out and spending to get any sort of top free agent center fielder. So we're kind of in that murky area where I don't know if anybody knows what to expect in center on opening day. Right now, you know, if I had to come up with an answer, I'd say some sort of combination of Tyler Collins and Jacoby Jones, with Jones eventually starting to get an edge in playing time as the season goes on and he learns a little bit. But we'll see. It could be one of those winners where maybe somebody lingers on the market that you can pick up and plug in who ends up turning in a better season than expected. The Young Tigers have had late off-season signings before. This year it would have to be at a little bit more of a cheaper cost. But that's the big mystery right now with center field.
Obviously, you know, we talked about how the market isn't particularly ripe to move a monster contract like a Miguel Cabrera or Justin Verlander. But, you know, one guy who's certainly movable, it's just a matter of do you want to do it, is Justin Wilson. You know, a valuable left-handed reliever in a market that's crazy for relief help right now. And he's two more years of arbitration before eligible for free agency. So certainly a lot of value there. But question is, do the Tigers explore that trade value?
I think they're definitely exploring it. I think that they're not getting the return that they would want in order to move him. I think part of the problem is that teams have a hard time defining what Justin Wilson is. He's a left-handed reliever. He's got a good arm. The stuff is top rate when he's on. But the history and the stats show that he's been more effective against right-handed batters than left-handed hitters. And he's been that way for a few years now. And so how do you use a guy like that? Do you still set him up for lefty-lefty matchups and figure you try to play off left-handed hitters' weaknesses? Or do you use him as more of like a traditional setup role as if he was right-handed, and then you feel like you can play him through different sorts of matchups and just look at the overall numbers? It's tough to really define a role for him when you look at him like that. And I think for that reason, in part, it's hard to figure out what he's worth on the trade market. And right now, the response from teams suggests that he's not worth nearly as much as what the Tigers believe he is. So he could potentially fall into another one of those holes where the Tigers are better off keeping him and letting him ride for a year, even though you're going to be paying a few million in arbitration, most likely.
All right, there you have it, the latest word from Jason Beck. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Kansas City Royals. I'm joined, as I am each and every week, by Jeffrey Flanagan. And Flanny, obviously 2016 did not go as intended for the Royals, and we're looking ahead here to 2017. And what might be next for this club? There's kind of a transition period underway. With the Wade Davis trade that brought in Jorge Soler. I'm just wondering, what's your expectation level between now and spring training for another trade of that nature, an expiring asset for more of a long-term asset? What are the odds we see another one of those?
I think they're pretty high. I think we're going to at least see one more deal, maybe to trim payroll a little bit more. I know there's been interest in Jerod Dyson and Lorenzo Cain. Now, both guys are going to be kind of hard to deal just because they're one-year guys. And as you know, those guys are hard to deal unless you're going to a big market who think they might have a chance at signing him long-term. And the other thing with Dyson is, you know, I've said this many times too, he's projected to make about $2.5 million through arbitration next year, which makes him a very cost-efficient option for other teams. But it also makes him a very cost-efficient guy for the Royals. So, you know, that makes it kind of tougher to trade him. But I think they'll probably have to make another deal. They did trade, you know, Wade Davis and got Jorge Soler for, and that probably saved them about $7 million. That got them down to a workable figure. You know, if they dealt maybe one more guy, you know, even if it was just a $2 or $3 million saving, maybe then they could come back and, you know, look for a fifth starter, a very cost efficient fifth starter, or a very low cost efficient bullpen guy, and that'll probably be about it. You know, Dayton Moore told me as he left the winter meetings that this is pretty much going to be the team you're going to see in spring training, and I think that's correct.
Yeah, and they're going to have to piece it together in the pen. I mean, you have a, you know, obviously Kelvin Herrera can slide in that closer's role. You feel pretty confident in that. But from there, it's a lot of question marks, including, you know, Matt Strand's role, who's so good for them down the stretch. But, you know, he's obviously, you know, has the potential to be stretched out as a starter again. So, so yeah, a lot of curiosity as far as the makeup of that bullpen. And this is an organization, of course, with a history, a recent history, of finding some diamonds in the rough, so to speak. They'll probably have to do that again.
Yeah, they definitely will. And you know, one of Dayton's mandates going into the offseason was to try to make that bullpen, you know, a shutdown bullpen again, which it was in 13, 14, and 15. And it's really hard to do that when you trade away its most elite team. So it's going to be a big challenge for him now. But I think he feels pretty confident. I talked to him a lot about it at the winter meetings that, you know, a kid like Matt Strom, who just burst onto the scene last August and was just dominant. Yeah, he could be stretched out as a fifth guy, but I think his value is much greater in the bullpen as an eighth inning guy or something like that. You know, you got to hope that Joaquin Soria bounces back and, you know, is at least serviceable as a setup guy. And I do believe they'll re-sign a guy like Peter Moylan, who even at 37 was pretty effective last year. And then there's a kid named Josh DeMont, who they've been – he's not even on the 40-man roster yet, but he's a kid who throws about 100 miles an hour and really turned it on in the second half last year at AA. And this organization has no issues with throwing a young kid like that in the bullpen. They're very confident. They did that with Matt Strom. They've done that with other guys. So I think there's a really good chance you'll be hearing that name a lot next year. And then they're going to, like you said, they're going to have to piece it together. They're going to have to find something else. And Dayton was pretty confident that could happen. He kept saying, hey, once you've got the anchor like Kelvin Herrera, we can piece a bullpen together, and he's pretty good at it.
Yeah, he certainly has a history of that. You know, when you look at the Royals, I mean, realistically, their biggest trade chip among the expiring contracts is Danny Duffy, just because of the market conditions at the starting pitcher and the kind of breakout season Duffy had. But certainly seems there's no intent to move that piece. I mean, the Royals, they're trying to do the hardest thing to do in sports, basically, which is contend and rebuild at the same time. But, you know, to contend, Duffy at the top of the rotation makes too much sense.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, and they've already started, you know, they've kind of kicked the tires on a long-term deal with them. And, well, if you take him out of the rotation, they're already, you know, you're down to three guys now, and you're not 100% sure that Jason Vargas will return to what he used to be, you know, coming off Tommy John. So that makes the rotation iffy. The bullpens are already iffy. So I just really can't see that happening. You know, Dayton did say before the winter meetings end, too, he's going to try to sign a few of these guys to long-term deals. He's not just going to let them all walk. Some are going to walk. There's no doubt about it. As a small market team, you're in Cleveland. You know the same drill there. You just can't afford to re-sign all these guys. You've got to kind of reload as you go along. It can be done. The Royals are going to try to prove that they can do it too.
Now, you think they'll play around at all with that logjam of first base DH types, primarily DH types, who could potentially head on a short-term deal? You know, the kind of the game of musical chairs works more for the teams than the players in this particular market. The Royals' DH situation currently lines up to be Chester Cuthbert, and, you know, maybe some Jorge Soler in that spot, or see how the outfield exactly shakes out, but it doesn't seem like they're particularly keen on exploring that market, but you just kind of wonder, maybe it does kind of play in their favor if they're patient with it in the next month or so.
Boy, it'd have to be really be a cost efficiency.
Really be.
Yeah. I mean, because they just trimmed $7 million, which got them right down to about a workable figure. And if you go and add some more, then you're right kind of back where you started. And they have really talked it up about this floating DH and you know, having a guy with Chester Cuthbert's offensive ability to be there. And he's out of options anyway, so if he's going to make the team, it's going to have to be as the DH. It gives them an opportunity to give guys like Sal Perez a day or two off, a half a day off, you know, every now and then. Lorenzo Cain, you know, to give him a half a day off and rest his legs. And even Eric Hosmer, who I think kind of wore down the stretch playing every day, he could get a half day off now. And so it kind of makes sense from their money situation, from their health situation, especially with the fatigue they showed last year and all the injuries they had, to make that a floating DH situation.
Yeah, I think that makes sense in general in today's game, and that's why we have the logjam we have in free agency. Yeah, the true DH is kind of a changing definition. So, all right. So, well,
sounds like a story idea to me.
Yeah, absolutely. The Royals will continue to push forward here in 2017, and Jeffrey Flanagan will be all over it for MLB.com. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals edition. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrins, and this is our latest look at the Minnesota Twins. I'm joined, as I am each week, by Rhett Bollinger. And, Rhett, we're kind of looking ahead to 2017 here. Obviously, 2016, you kind of want to flush that one down the toilet from a Twins perspective. It was a rough one. Did not take the strides they hoped to take, but big change in the front office, and then a move right away to shore up the catching spot with Jason Castro. And now we're kind of in this transition period with the roster. You know, been a lot of speculation out there about what might be ahead with Brian Dozier. Of course, the Dodgers lineup is maybe a perfect trade partner. And we've seen Jose De Leon's name floated as a potential trade candidate if such a deal were to go down. Kind of just what the doctor ordered as far as what the Twins need for the long term with some controllable pitching with high upside, and that's what De Leon is. But what are your expectations, first of all, on the Dozier front? Do you think this is something that has a lot of legs to it?
I do. I think at this point it's becoming more and more likely that it will happen. It doesn't mean that it has to happen, but I do think at this point it's getting more and more toward that you know, scenario happening, especially with the Dodgers kind of being, they said, the most likely team. With the De Leon's potential, you know, ace pitcher, or some of the Twins would definitely covet a guy, I think, struck out more than 11 batters per nine innings in the minor leagues. They obviously have a couple other, you know, top prospects as well. They could fit in there. I'm sure the Twins would probably want at least, you know, three guys as part of a package for Dozier. Dozier has two more years left on his deal. And as we know, you know, hit 42 home runs last year, only $15 million left on that deal. So certainly a team-friendly deal. The hard thing, I think, is just trying to find other takers in the moment, in a sense. You know, only other team we've really seen as a possibility has been the Yankees. But even they, Brian Cashman kind of shot that down as a possibility. They obviously already have Starlin Castro at second base. A lot of the contenders already have a second baseman. So I think unless, you know, Dodger's willing to switch to third base, it's going to be tough to find another team that really matches up. Certainly you could look at teams, maybe the Phillies being a second baseman, but, you know, those type of teams, are they really, you know, looking to compete in the next 2 years? That's kind of the thing, is trying to find that team that, A, is going all in to win right now over the next few seasons, because that's all they'll have Dozier for, and also has the young pitching to pull off the trade. Obviously, you know, the Angels are a team, maybe it's been mentioned as a team that needs a second baseman, although they traded for Espinoza. So same thing. Kind of a lot of these candidates are kind of getting whittled down. So to me, I think at some point, I think if anything, they're probably just haggling over what the pieces are going to be, maybe around De Leon with the Dodgers. I think that still makes the most sense. The Twins could obviously hang on to Dozier. He's a big part of that team and a huge part of that clubhouse, and could be traded at the trade deadline. He still has a year and a half, you know, if he retraded at the deadline. So it doesn't mean it has to happen, but I think at this point, it just makes too much sense with the Dodgers needing a second baseman and having the prospects to pull off the deal for it not to be a matchup at some point this offseason.
Yeah, it's one of those where it's certainly speculated in day one of a hot stove season, and a lot of times speculation is just that. But it certainly makes a ton of sense, I'd say, for both sides. And it's, you know, as emotionally difficult as it would be, you know, from a marketing perspective, from a, you know, again, from an emotional perspective to trade Dozier, I think it just makes so much sense for this franchise, because you can bring back the kind of pieces. I mean, his value might never be higher than it is at this moment. So we'll see what the future holds there. Anything else brewing on the Twins front in this hot stove season?
I think the big thing for them is going to be trying to get, you know, starting pitching, I think. I think we'll see what happens with the Dozier trade. Obviously, they could bring them someone like De Leon. Irvin Santana's name's been floated out there a little bit as well. I'm a little bit more bullish that'll actually happen. I don't think it's going to happen in a sense. I think that talking to, you know, people in the front office, especially even during the season, they weren't very, you know, enticed by wanting to trade him just because they knew that he was kind of the one starting pitcher last year who was, you know, consistent for them, had a great year. He still has 2 years left on his deal as well. So I think that they kind of see him still kind of as that rotation anchor, but they'll certainly listen. I think the big thing, like, you know, Falvey said, is they'll listen on anybody. I mean, even prospects, anybody they'll listen on. They're definitely open-minded, especially as a new front office. But I think, you know, Santana certainly will, you know, draw some interest. But I think at this point, with the Twins looking for starting pitching more than anything to improve that starting pitching, I think they'll probably hold on to him. And like I said, I think at this point, Dozier's still kind of the main name you keep hearing and kind of has really dominated this offseason for the Twins so far.
I know the Twins added Justin Haley in the Rule 5 draft, you know, speaking of the search for starters. And generally, if a guy sticks from the Rule 5 draft, it's more commonly in the bullpen. But do you see Haley getting a chance to remain stretched out? He was a starter in the minor leagues last year.
I think he'll get a chance to get stretched out. As you said, he did start last year in the minor leagues. I think it's one of those things where it's always easier to have a guy come in the spring training ready to start than vice versa, just because, you know, you can always have him come in ready to start, have him stretched out early, and then convert him to, you know, bullpen if he has to, rather than have him come in as a reliever, and it's hard to get, you know, obviously worked up as a starter, you know, and kind of get, you know, pitches built up and everything that way. So I think they'll have him come into camp as a starter. Realistically, he probably doesn't have much of a chance to really be a starting coming out of opening day. But I do think he'll, you know, if he pitches well in spring training, he'll have every chance to make the team as more of a long reliever and potentially maybe even a spot starter when needed. We've seen the Twins do this kind of thing in the past with guys like J.R. Graham and Ryan Pressly made the team and the whole year. And Pressly now has become a, you know, pretty big part of this bullpen. So, and lastly, we saw guys, you know, Biagini had a great year in Toronto. We've seen a lot of, you know, Rule 5 guys stick and actually become a big part of that, you know, bullpen. So it's a smart move for the Twins to make that trade at number one and kind of a little creative way they ended up acquiring him. But I do think that he's got a good shot to make the team, but I do think that as a starter, probably not.
Rhett, one last thing I want to touch on. When you think about 2017, one guy who will be a focal point, not unlike 2016, is Byron Buxton. In 2016, there goes plan, but he did finish the season strong. And I found it interesting late in the year, and you wrote about this, he was named to our All-StatCast team, which I know is not quite as big an honor as like an All-Star team, but it's certainly the StatCast system helps us understand, you know, where Buxton's talents lie, and it kind of highlights him as a true five-tool talent. So, again, this guy has all the makeup of a star in this game. I think maybe we started to see the seeds of that in September, but you know, you wrote that story about him being named the All-StatCast team. What'd you come away with?
Yeah, the big thing with him, as he said, is he's definitely a five-tool prospect in a sense. He hasn't really put together that hit tool yet, or really even a power tool other than obviously that last month here in the majors. But as you said, as a StatCast star, I mean, the guy has every tool he possibly could have. I mean, the guy was throwing, you know, 99 miles per hour from the outfield. You know, he has that power. I mean, he has legitimate power. It hasn't really translated to the game outside of that last month. But that speed, as we know, too, is just incredible. I mean, some of those catches he made and running around the bases to get to, you know, fastest StatCast time ever to home. You know, he's reached 22 miles per hour as well in the bases and in the field. So to him, I mean, to the teams, he's definitely their most important player going forward just because he's the one guy in the organization who can really do it all. And it's such a rare thing to have a player who can be that, you know, do everything center fielder, who can hit for power, who can have that kind of speed. I mean, it's so rare to have. Not that he's ever going to be to that level of Mike Trout, but, you know, Andrew McCutchen-type player, you know, one of these guys that, you know, is kind of the leader of the team and also, you know, can do all, you know, five tools here. I think Buxton can be that guy, and I think September certainly was kind of a taste of what could come. Because as we know, and we talked about a lot, he really struggled there with the strikeouts and everything else in his first couple go-rounds in the majors. And sure enough, you know, came up September 1st in that last, you know, 29 games, what, he had 9 home runs and obviously showed off his speed with a lot of doubles and triples as well and stolen bases. So if he can kind of get going and become that leadoff hitter top of the lineup and kind of do that, you know, do everything guy, it would be a lot towards setting this team kind of, you know, sort of faster trajectory in terms of getting back to being a competitive team. So the tools are certainly there, and it's certainly fun to watch, and I can't wait to continue to, you know, see what he does with all the StatCast stuff we can measure now, because he certainly is Statcast All-Star for sure.
All right, there you have it. The latest word from Rhett. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.